Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to New Books in Anthropology, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Reagan Gillum, a host on the channel, and today I'm talking to Dr. Kwame Edwin Atu, who is the author of the book Amphibious Subjects, Sasso and the Contested Politics of Queer Self-Making in Neoliberal Ghana, published by the University of California Press. Dr. Atu, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so very much for having me, Reagan.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to talking about your book today. And I wanted to just start with a question that we normally begin with, which is, how did you come to write the book? And can you tell us about yourself, anything about your background, and what sparked your interest in queer lives and community in Ghana?
Thank you so very much for having me once again. And thank you so much for this opportunity to talk about the book. I think this would be the very first platform on which I'm discussing the contours of the book. And So to answer your question, I would say that I came to, my life really sparked all my being, you know, sparked the book, really. It was the impetus, it was the impulse for writing this book. And I really wanted to think about myself, you know, in the book as a queer subject, who, you know, was raised in a country that told me that being queer was impossible, or that church that being queer was not Ghanaian or was not African, right? So growing up in a society that literally gives you a narrative that erases you, but then your body tells you something else, right? Your desire tells you something else. So how do you reconcile with your experience in your body or what you actually sense, right, with what the world is telling you, this, you know, heteronormative, if you will, world. So I think that was a spark. But I took a course in graduate school called Culture and AIDS. And that class was taught by a cultural anthropologist. And it was actually a class that somehow offered me with this opportunity to think about, you know, homosexuality. At the time, I had not really yet explored the concept of queer, right, or very idea of queerness and queer identity. I was interested in homosexuality because this class on culture and AIDS really deployed a medical anthropological approach to studying, you know, homosexuality. And so, or to deploy the medical anthropological approach to studying AIDS. When we got to the Africa section, the ways in which AIDS was construed really shocked me. Right, in Africa alone, unlike the other continents, AIDS transmission was reduced to heterosexual transmission, right? And I was like, but there are homosexuals in Africa, right? So where are the homosexuals in these medical narratives on HIV and AIDS that are being parroted by public health organizations as if to say that there were no homosexuals or gay men in Africa who were also victims of the HIV and AIDS pandemic, right? And so the class sparked an interest in me to really pursue this you know, passion, this thing that became my passion for queer projects in Ghana. And that took me down this rabbit hole, really. I wanted to just prove to the class and to the professor that, listen, interpretation of HIV and AIDS in Africa is reinforcing this Pavlovian description of Africa as a space or a continent without homosexuals, right? So my paper was intended then, my final paper for that class was intended to really critique and interrogate, you know, this assertion that HIV and AIDS in Africa was really heterosexual transmission, right? And I think that really opened the pathway for me to begin to explore more about this project. But again, so I think my point, my answer to your question is, I entered this book in a dual way. One is through my own experience as someone who knew themselves to be gay or to be different or to be living a life that was not actually in alignment with what society told me that I was. And two, the class gave me an opportunity to also really delve deeper into these kinds of assumptions that erase and omit queer subjects from public health conversations on HIV and AIDS.
Now, that's really interesting, and it's really great to hear people's their kind of origin stories and entry points into these projects. So, and that takes me to my next question, which is, of course, so you know, your passion for the project comes through in that you give us this ethnography of queer self-making in Ghana. And so you take as your main focus, the Sasso community in Jamestown, Ghana. And I wanted to ask this question of, can you describe aspects of the Sasso community? And I also ask this because I think listeners wouldn't necessarily know, you know, instantly, you know, what is Sasso? And so to you, so what does Sasso mean?
So Sasso means, thank you for that question. Sasso really is the Ga term for co-equal, right? In Akan, which is my mother tongue, it's Sasso. Right. So if someone tells you that you are not my co-equal, it's actually a claim of superior, a claim to superiority that you are not my co-equal. Right. So Sasso as a term is redeployed by self-identified effeminate men. So there are many iterations of Sasso as I discovered during my ethnography. That Sasso is co-equal. That's etymological roots for the term. But then self-identified effeminate man, as I describe in the book as Sasso, right? So that is the noun, right? But then Sasso is also a verb, right? People who engage in homoerotic encounters would be seen as Sasso or as engaging in Sasso. Right. So they do not necessarily have to be self-identified effeminate men, nor should they be, you know, men. Right. Which means that women who have sex with women or women who engage in homoerotic encounters could also be Sasso. Right. And Sasso could also be just an adjectival thing. Right. It describes how one, you know, exacts or exudes their mannerisms. So then, you know, you might be effeminate, but not be engaging in you may be effeminate, but you wouldn't engage in homoeroticism, right? That makes you Sasso too within this universe. So it's a very complicated, I call it pluriverse of identification. Sasso historically or originally means co-equal, but then self-identified effeminate men in this community have really, in Jamestown in particular, have redeployed or have mobilized Sasso, they've taken Sasso because Sasso is also less problematic in many ways, right? Sasso doesn't carry the baggage that, for example, lesbian, bisexual, gay, transgender, queer, plus carries, nor does it carry the baggage that kwejobisia, which is actually the term for a man who acts like a woman, carries, right? Because kwejobisia is more derogatory. And kwejobisia, as it were, is really what a lot of Ghanaians knew queer people to be, queer men in particular, right? So Sasso then becomes a more palatable way of describing this community of self-identified effeminate men. And so somehow you have to be within the Sasso network to know what Sasso means, right? So if you're not part of the network, you wouldn't know. So it's really a code that allows them to also deflect and to, you know, put on hold any potential of homophobia.
That is fascinating. Wow, that's very, very interesting. The use of that term and how you use it to describe the community in lieu of these other kind of Western terms that many of us would instantly think about. And so I wanted to take us to, I guess, the beginning of the book where you begin the book with this arrival scene into Accra, Ghana. And so your arrival scene into the country is also the reader's arrival scene into the book and into its narrative. And so you open up the book with this encounter with a sign. And the sign is, I'm going to quote from the sign. And so using the sign's terms. And so the sign is warning against, quote, sexually abhorrent behaviors and warns against, quote, pedophiles and sexual deviants. And it says, you know, they should stay away from the country. And so I wondered for you, you know, what does the sign tell us about the sexual norms that the state is trying to enforce in Ghana?
So let me tell you my very first encounter, how I reacted upon seeing that sign for the first time, if you don't mind a little anecdote. So I had actually arrived in Ghana for the first time, I think, in 2011. To start this project. And, you know, I had been in the US then for almost 5 years. I hadn't been back to Ghana. So I was now out, I had been out in the US and I was going to Ghana as a very different person. Clearly my masculinity had changed. I was not like the Kwame who left Ghana in 2007 and was, you know, endowed with this Christian masculinity, right? So when I say Christian masculinity, I mean, I had a short hair, I was very prim and proper, respectable, dressed and wore, like tucked in, iron my shirt, as Christian men do in Ghana. I was this like very Victorian Ghanaian who left the shores of Accra in 2007. And in 2011, I returned and I had my locks. You know, I have these locks. I am in tight jeans. I'm just sashaying my way around the airport. Get off the plane. So I get off the plane, walk by the immigration booths, only to be greeted by the sign on the wall. So suddenly, Professor Julem, I had to modify my body, right? I had to actually not draw too much attention to the ways in which I was presenting my masculinity because my masculinity was not in consonance with the hegemonic notions of masculinity of the Ghanaian nation, I realized, right? So I had to remodify. It was a corporeal kind of rearrangement that I had to do. So I had to actually then, you know, make sure my chest was out. I had the broad shoulders, then, you know, carried my bag and then walked to, you know, it was this kind of performance of masculinity as a way of deflecting attention from my new queer masculinity, if you will, right? And so that was my first reaction to the sign. I just wanted to share that. But what the sign also told me was this idea that, oh, all these deviant acts, whatever those mean, of pedophilia, because they're actually, you know, grouping pedophilia in with other sexually aberrant acts. And of course, the sexually aberrant acts aren't specified, but then we do know, right? We do know what they mean. It's a code for something, right? Something that is seemingly out there, right? So then pedophiles are not within Ghana, that pedophiles come to Ghana, that Ghana is actually a space where pedophilia does not exist, right? It's also a space where sexually aberrant acts do not exist. So the nation is really construing this purified sense of itself, that these acts have to come from the outside. They have to be alien, right? So the fact that the airport, which is the portal of arrival, becomes the precise domain at which these aberrant acts are confiscated or, you know, or held at bay was fascinating to me because the nation was really marking its ground. It was marking its territory. Right. And for me, that was what the sign was doing, that the sign is simply telling us that Ghana sees itself as, you know, a space where everything is a very decorous space, a very moral space, and that any form of immorality, whatever that means, comes out of Ghana and cannot be found within Ghana, right? So the sign really then polices sexual citizenship, right? That you have to conform within the parameters of what Ghanaians want, right? And what it did for me at that moment was to really think about the ways in which Ghana asserted itself or presented itself to the bigger world or the wider world, right? Ghana wants to see... be this kind of, you know, icon in the West African, you know, sub-region as a space of not just hospitality, but then there are also Christian sentiments, right, that are actually underneath or that are the subtext for this sign. So that was my reading of the sign, right, that the sign is intended to mark Ghana as primarily free of pedophilia, free of any sexually aberrant behavior, including homosexuality or queerness. And so Ghana has to be the place where moral beings are created, or it's an unscathed domain.
Mm-hmm. Now, I like that, how you bring in the antidote and your reading of the sign, because you tell us how you bodily had to reconfigure yourself in line with this idea of Ghana as this, you know, moral space, as you said, with, you know, with this, where Christianity is dominant and there is no homosexuality. And that takes us back to what you said earlier also about how, you know, people exist and yet they're told that their sexualities don't exist. And so that takes me then to the title of the book again, The Amphibious Subjects, because you describe Sasso as having amphibious subjectivities. And of course, as I said, that's also the title of the book. And so I wonder too, then, can you tell us about this idea of the amphibious subject? What does it mean? How do you theorize this term?
Thank you very much. So I think let's go back then to the scene at the airport and my performance, right? My switch from this queer masculinity to this Christian masculinity as becoming the basis for what becomes the term amphibious, right? That the amphibian as a creature or as a being is one that lives on both land and in water, right? The airport space, which is also a kind of liminal space, serves as the boundary at which I switch from being queer, which was my identity until I left the plane, right, into Ghana. So then the back and forth, right, between my queer masculinity and my Ghanaian Christian hetero masculinity becomes a kind of framework. But I need to actually, before amphibious, I was going to use reluctant as I was thinking about reluctance as the optic for thinking about this project, right? And I realized that reluctance would not quite catch what I was doing. And so, you know, when I was using reluctance, I was going to call the piece Reluctantly Queer, and that is really where I get the title for the film, which we'll talk about. But like, Reluctantly Queer was not quite doing it for me as an intellectual, as a thinker, and as an anthropologist, precisely because with reluctance, I was using a lot of Western theory to think about queer subjectivity. But with amphibious subjects, I had someone to go to, Kwame Jichi, right? And so in the field, right, I saw that these Sasso men had to actually embody multiple selves at their work, at their churches, with their friends, at the NGOs they work, in the public sphere, right? And so it is a shape-shifting tendencies of these men that actually compelled me to actually to look to amphibian or the amphibious subject as a very useful theoretical framing for situating or making sense of Sasso subjectivity or their forms of self-fashioning, right? So having been in the field and seeing the ways in which these men, you know, fashion themselves, because I was with them, their families, I went with them to churches, we went to ritual spaces, we went to them to the, I went to their NGOs. And in all of these domains, right, they were enacting forms of selves that were not always uniform. Right. So for me, the amphibian as a heuristic became so critical, more so than reluctance, Right. I was like, they are not being reluctant. They are just really embodying or manifesting what Kwame Gyekyee calls the amphibious personhood. Right. And so that is how I came to the term. Not sure if that responds to your question here.
Oh, that absolutely responds to the question. And it tells us exactly what I also picked up in the book about the amphibian and how it's on, you know, land and water and how it has to negotiate between these different terrains in its, you know, in its subjecthood. And so you mentioned also Kwame Gyekyee and his idea of amphibious personhood. And I wondered, I have this question, I guess, about your use of a Ghanaian philosopher in the book. And I'm thinking about this quote that you have in the conclusion of the book. And so my question is going to come in the context of this quote. And so the quote is, "Queer Africa is much more than Michel Foucault and Judith Butler. It is lazy to always start queer African narratives with either this French philosopher or his American compatriot." And this is from Stella Nyanzi in Queering Queer Africa. And so I guess in the context of this question, what was it meaningful for you to use a Ghanaian philosopher to build these theories about Ghanaian people?
It was super meaningful because, of course, already the discourses around queerness basically say that, you know, queer subjectivities are Western, right? So why would I actually want to study that by rehearsing queer theories from the West, right? Because then I'll be giving fodder to critics of queer subjectivities in Ghana to say that this is the point, this is why it's Western. So Kwame Gyekyee's theorization comes in so handily, right? It allows for me to actually root the study in the context of Ghana. It is a Ghanaian subjectivity, right? And the ways in which Sassou themselves embody being Sassou is quite reminiscent of what Gyekyee is doing in his analysis of personhood. Right. So he couldn't be a more appropriate intellectual or interlocutor theoretically for me. Right. That he had already given me, he had the language, he also had the insights, plus he's also a philosopher. But then again, I was also like so disinterested in the Western theories because I'm like, we do have there's a fecund opportunity. We have this privilege and capital, philosophical capital in our own domains. Why don't we, you know, exploit these opportunities? Gyekyee is waiting to be seen. Gyekyee actually taught me. So why would I actually, you know, look somewhere else? Because they are white, that makes them more philosophical than Gyekyee. When Gyekyee is really ethnographically grounding their philosophy, he may not have been an ethnographer, but then clearly his philosophical contributions are deeply rooted in what is arguably Ghanaian culture, right? So I already had that framework set for me. All I had to do was to pluck from it, and it made sense in the context of the project. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I like that term, philosophical capital. That's a great term. And then, you know, and then you kind of ethnographically ground it and put some sort of empirical meat on those bones, which is what, you know, anthropologists tend to do. Like that's our project. And so in that, I wanted to dive into your ethnography because the book really includes these descriptive scenes of community life. And so in chapter 3, for example, you talk about the Sasso community rituals, where they're attending birthday parties and what are called, I guess, outdoorings or christenings. And so these are ritual spaces. And of course, you know, anthropologists would understand that these are spaces of ambiguity and spaces of kind of freedom from the social structure. And so what were these rituals like? And how do these rituals help us understand the Sasso community and amphibious personhood?
So rituals are actually as Ghanaian as it gets. You know, on a weekend, like Friday, Saturday, Sunday, is either a wedding, an outdooring, a funeral. The Dutch anthropologist Zak van der Geest even has this article entitled Funerals for the Living. It is his little ethnography on Ghana where he says that funerals in Ghana are actually rituals for the living just because of just how widespread and so prevalent they are. So for me, rituals are already like an everyday experience, right? And Sasso, as I did this project, are so centrally involved in rituals, in spite of the very heteronormative nature of these rituals. So growing up in Ghana, this project really then somehow also allowed me to time travel into the past to make sense of how also Sasso have always been there. Right, these men are either cooking, right? They are either the masters of ceremonies. They are doing something industrious in the space to make sure that the ritual is a success, right? And they are being effeminate in these spaces, but nobody questions them. So of course, their labor in the space of the ritual, right, is actually exploited, but then beyond the ritual. So there are multiple liminalities here, right? That the ritualized space really becomes a space where you can be feminine, maybe because your labor has been exploited, or maybe because in that space and that space alone, your labor or you are seen as someone with a talent, right? And so we are not going to remind you, or you're not going to be interpolated as Sasso in that space, or you're not going to be called Kwejo Bisia, you're not going to be booed at for being effeminate, right? So the ritualized space then becomes a space where Sasso really tries to compensate for the so many things that society disallows them from having, right? And so the birthday and the christening ceremony I witnessed were so significant because, again, at these spaces, Sasso's identities become legitimate because they are integral. Like, they run, they are the, I say that they are the heartbeat, in fact, of these rituals, right? And that was one of the things I was trying to actually disentangle in the piece, is that why is such a heteronormative ritual so reliant, right, on subjects who are actually, or whose existence, whose bodies, whose being, right, are actually in contradistinction with the heteronormative formation, the ritual that is, right? And that, for me, was so critical because the ritualized space then was not a space where it wasn't an anti or for against there. I think I was trying to, Reagan, I was trying to think through the ways in which the ritual afforded us with an opportunity to think about, you know, what some queer scholars have called anti-normativity, that it is not always in collision, that like being queer does not mean you have to be in opposition to heteronormativity, that these structures are actually very intricately intertwined, and that the ritualized domain makes these intertwinements very palpable, right? So rather than see, you know, heteronormativity or heteroerotic formations as always button heads or being in opposition with homoerotic tendencies, that in fact the ritual somehow reveals or exposes those, you know, mutual entanglements, right? Those unforeseen affinities or unimagined alliances that exist between heteronormative rituals and homonormative subjects, heteronormative rituals and homoerotic leaning or gender non-conforming subjects. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thank you so much for that. And so another place you went to these, you know, rituals, and we see them in the book. And then another place where you were, as you had said earlier, you were in these NGOs. And in the book, you describe the compulsory homosexuality of the NGOs, and they have these, you know, various programs and agendas. And so there, it seems like the ones you were going to are involved in sexual health and rights. But it seems like they're also very constraining in their understandings of sexuality. And so how do Sasso lives, you know, exceed these understandings of sexuality that the NGOs put forth?
So thank you so much. So there was something about in the book that I call, maybe I did not put that in the book, so pardon me. It's called, you know, pretentious conformity. It's a term I wanted to use. And when I say pretentious conformity, this desire to conform by pretending, right? And so then the NGOs are themselves engaging in that pretentious conformity. But then I am imagining this pretentious conformity, which could be this compulsory heterosexuality, right, as as a reflection or an iteration of why amphibiousness is useful, right? Because the organizations themselves have to give, you know, this air of, you know, so of course, a lot of these sexual health projects, they use sexual health projects, but then under the banner of sexual health, they're actually dealing with not just people living with HIV and AIDS, victims of domestic, victims of sexual and gender-based violence, but they're also dealing with queer people, right? So even the use of men who have sex with men, for example, right, within by these organizations, is a way to mask, right, the fact that they're actually engaging with or in conversation with homosexual men, because homosexuality, mind you, in Ghana is illegal or is criminalized, right? So these NGOs are actually in a very dicey situation. On the one hand, they want to actually reach out to the queer community because they are human rights communities, but then the members within the organization themselves hold on to their own beliefs, right? How can you work in an organization that reaches out to queer people and be Christian? And so there were these tensions within the organization as to what the primary commitments of the organization were, right? And the ways in which these primary commitments or goals and objectives were always somehow conflicting with their own moral, you know, orientations, if you will, which were mostly deeply rooted in Christianity or Islam, right? So the pretentious conformity then was enacted both by the members of the NGOs as well as the SASO who worked in the NGOs, right? It's like, we are not going to talk about the fact that you are SASO, right? We are not going to talk about the fact that the SASO are also not going to talk about the fact that we know you are homophobic. So let's all live in this situation together and pretend we don't know what each other is. Does that make sense?
Yes, that is fascinating. I like that. And you mentioned the Christianity of the workers and how some of these norms are rooted in Christianity. And so that takes me to my next question, which is, like, Christianity is ever present in the book. It's present in the lives of the SASO who you talk to, who are attending church. They consider themselves to be good Christians. Some of them are kind of have these leadership roles in the church, but they still kind of experience this non-belonging, I think. And so what is the role of Christianity in sexual culture of Ghana? And then also I had this question of, did you know that Christianity was going to play this role in the book that it plays? And I asked this as someone who, you know, we start off with these projects and we go into the field and sometimes just these other areas emerge that we may not have previously thought, oh, this is going to be, you know, a bigger thing. So that's where that question comes from about, did you know that Christianity was going to play such a big role?
You know, wow, that's a very good question. It's a very good question because this is what happens when you are raised Christian. That, because I'm coming from a very conservative family, my parents are Presbyterian, that Christianity, to be honest with you, Dr. Jilam, is an afterthought, really. I mean, because I am Christian or I was raised Christian, not that I am now, but it never really registered as a category to analyze, right? Or as a unit of analysis, because, like, oh, I'm Christian, everybody in Ghana is Christian, so what's the big deal, right? But I think ethnography has a way, and I think that was the usefulness of returning home as the outsider within, to use Patricia Hill Collins' system. But there's something about being a native ethnographer, that you are no longer as native as you think you were, right? So I arrive and I'm like, oh yeah, you know, what's going on? I was focused mainly on the government. I was focused mainly on people and homophobia. And at some point, Christianity was just really not occurring to me. But then it was always there. It was something I could not avoid. So I actually came to the Christian section when I went into the archive. Because when I went to the School of Oriental, like the Missionary Collections, which is actually at the School of Oriental and African Studies, SOAS, in London. And in the archive, I see all these documents and correspondences between churches in the UK and Ghana, right, trying to actually, you know, pursue projects to end polygamy, right, in Ghana. And I'm like, oh my God, like, this is like Christian NGOs, right? Working to proselytize and, you know, make monogamy the thing, because monogamy was being marketed or parroted as what would make Ghana a modern nation after the British left, right? So that is actually the other way I entered, that my entrance, the Christian bit, really came through my engaging with the archive. Right. And then that is what then opened me up back to the ethnography and the preponderance of Christianity everywhere. I think the archive made me better understand why Christianity is so widespread in Ghana, and the fact that what is happening now cannot better be understood if we do not return to these historical artifacts, you know, that helped to shape and consolidate Christianity in Ghana. So, yeah. It was an afterthought in a way.
Yeah, no, it was very interesting. I liked it. I wasn't necessarily expecting it, but you know, when you read ethnographies, you don't know everything. That's why you read them. And so that was just a really nice added layer to the world that you were, you know, exploring in the book and analyzing for us. So I really like that. And then you talked about earlier how you were going to use this term reluctant. And so this takes me to your short film, Reluctantly Queer, which you wrote and starred in. And I wondered if you wanted to tell us about the film. And I haven't seen the film, but you do talk about films in the book as well, the films that these NGOs were producing about queer Ghanaians. And so I wonder, too, if your film might be kind of a representation that challenges these NGO representations in expanding the field of images about queer Ghana.
Right. Thank you. So reluctant. That film was written as an epistolary film, a letter to my mother, because I'm very, very, I'm an only child. So my mom and I are like, you know, best friends, or we're best friends, you know, and then you come out and your mom is like, hey, you know, this is not who you are. Is this what America has made you into? And so, you know, I go to Ghana and I tell my parents actually, I think my parents always knew I was queer, but, you know, when I knew I was not going to call my book or dissertation Reluctantly Queer, I knew I was not going to call it Reluctantly Queer because it was about me. I was a reluctant subject. I was the one who was reluctant to come out to my parents. And I was imposing this autoethnographic experience on my interlocutors, who clearly did not have to be reluctant because they lived in Ghana, they used Sasso, and you know, it was actually a kind of a public secret that these men engaged in or were engaged in homoerotic encounters right in Jamestown. So why would I come in as a researcher and then impose, right, my own understanding of being queer on them? So I still had, I did not want to do away with reluctance. I wanted to rescue it. And so the outlet of the film or the experimental film became useful because that was the only way I could actually recuperate or restore reluctance as a useful analytic for Kwame Otu, right? So it's a letter to my mother, and in it I'm trying to basically say that, listen, I'm what is home for me as a queer subject. You know, I know that if I, as a queer African subject, what does it mean to be in pursuit of a home? I go to Ghana, I can't be gay, and here I'm a black person, right? So how do you, what does the concept of home mean when in the US I can't be, the US is often construed in the Ghanaian imaginary as a citadel or a mecca of queer liberation. But then if you are queer and black in the US, as a black person, you know, as a queer person, your blackness undercuts whatever liberatory potential that this country is supposed to afford you, right? So the letter was then, in fact, trying to tell my mother that, listen, I don't have any home, because even in the US, being a black subject really means, you know, being or like living in a space of fearing death all the time. And what does that mean? And in Ghana, the same thing applies to being a queer subject. You live in a constant state of precarity or uncertainty, right? So what do I call home? And I think deep down in that film is also my kind of criticism to all these Western NGOs and Western documentarians who actually portray the West as a safe space. Because the West is definitely not a safe space for queer Black subjects or queer subjects of color. And that is what I was trying to convey in the film, which is that my African diasporic queer comrades, right, do not find this place a safe place for them because this is not a home. So where do we find us a home? And that was what I was trying to get with Reluctantly Queer in my conveyance of this dilemma to my mother.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was really well said. I'm also an only child, but also I like this question of like, what does the ethnographer do with all of, with this material? Like, what do you do with your concepts and your ideas, and where do you put them, and how do you express them? And some mediums are better than others. So film might express one thing, and then the book another thing. So that's really lovely to think about. There doesn't have to be an end. You know, it can continue. So then I wanted to ask you also about your research methods. And so the book is, of course, very ethnographic, and you have these, you know, scenes and encounters, and you go into the lives of Sasso. You have all of these interviews and conversations. And I wondered about how you navigated the kind of the stigmatization or the stigma associated with the topic. And, you know, you enter into this community and share their lives. And it seems like they might be saying things that kind of remain unsaid to their families or to other people. And so it's just a question of how you navigate this, you know, this terrain of ethnographic research in this area.
You know, as someone who was born in Ghana and left Ghana and went back to Ghana, I did not go back to Ghana just as a queer person, right? I went to Ghana also as a privileged subject, right? I had lived in the US for 5 years. I've now inherited this, you know, idea of I was within the proximity of Imperial America or whatever that is. And in Ghana, that is a big deal. That is actually what I call, you know, racial capital working for you through proximity to the US. So I think that methodologically that I, unlike other Ghanaian scholars who would have had a lot of difficulty identifying a queer community like I did, that I felt the gateway or the floodgates were open for me, because most of these men, the Sasso, saw me not as a Ghanaian, really. They saw me as a diasporic subject. So I was a safe person for them to be around, right? That, so then being diasporic, eerily makes you open. And I think that's one of the things we need to talk about, which is, you know, how the idea is that if you're coming from the West, you know, you must be open-minded, you must be embracing. But that has never always been the case, because there's some very, very close-minded Westerners, right? But, you know, in many parts of Africa, the assumption is that, you know, the West will be tolerant, especially in the LGBT human rights movement, right? So queer people somehow assume that all people from the West are tolerant. And I'm like, no, that is not what happens. But that sensibility, that ideology, if you will, really created the opportunity for me to be able to access them, that I was a privileged person. They saw me now as an African-American in so many ways. They even called me, I am the American man, right? Which then removes any sense of Ghanaianness from me, right? And so I think that identity, this new identity, this new Kwame, right, made it easy. And I say this because I went to an NGO event. Dr. Jilam, it was so interesting. And at the event, two of the Sasso who were there were my colleagues from college. I went to college in Ghana, right? And they in college knew me not to be, I wasn't out then, right? So of course they had their suspicions that I was queer, but I was still this very respectable Victorian Christian man, right? So when they saw me at the event, they had their suspicions. They were like, should we trust this guy, right? At the time, they did not know I had traveled. But the other people in the audience knew I had traveled, and they told them that, oh, he's actually one of us, right? And he's actually coming from the US. So they held on to what the old Kwame, Rabbi the Sasso, who had I had met, knew the new Kwame, and they had to actually temper their anxieties by saying that, oh no, he is cool. He's cool people. You should trust him. He's not going to actually out you to anyone. You are in a safe space with him here, right? So that moment really struck me as very interesting because there were two conflicting understandings of who Kwame was. And it was a very critical ethnographic juncture of, again, going back to the idea of the native, right? That they held on to this idea of my nativity, right? And or nativeness. And the Sasso that I had just met thought I was American, right? So it was a very, very interesting experience.
Mm-hmm. That's really interesting, and how we always have to take ourselves into account when we go into these situations and we learn things about ourselves as we encounter different people. I found that as well. And so I have this question. So I wondered your thoughts about ethnography in Africa or African studies. And so I asked this because I've seen these, you know, controversies and critiques in African studies. I have to confess, like, mainly I've learned about them through Twitter. But they raise these questions about who studies African communities, what is, you know, what kind of information is shared, how is Africa represented? And I don't know that these questions have ever gone away. Like, I took a class on peoples and cultures of Africa, which, you know, is what anthropology classes tend to be called. And like 2000 at University of Virginia. And so, you know, these were some questions that the professor was raising. But so I just mean to say that, you know, maybe these aren't new. But so I wondered if you have any thoughts, you know, about African studies, how your work fits into it, and then, you know, what you'd want people to take away from your work.
Thank you very much. So I really appreciate that question, not least because it gives me an opportunity here to talk about how I feel African anthropologists, and I didn't say Africanist, right? African anthropologists' entrance into the realm of ethnography, right? Our increasing entrance is going to really create a huge upset in many ways. It's going to upset colonial ethnography, which now continues as neo-colonial ethnography, just as the debates on Twitter unfolded, right? I feel that we are going to, with the entrance of natives into anthropology, African natives in particular, like myself, that we are going to see a revival. I'm also thinking that African anthropology, the premise on which African anthropology is built, is going to shift radically, right? Because the foundations of African anthropology is still peculiarly deeply rooted in Eurocentrism. Right. And so my work is one of the ways my work, I would hope, right, represents a break from this, you know, genuflection at the altar of Eurocentrism. I'm like, no, we need to really look to African culture, African theoretical paradigms, because they are there. They do not even have to be written. We have oral tradition. We have symbolic objects, symbolic worldviews, idiosyncratic symbology. All of these things are there, right? And so I am interested in the departure. And the departure the colonial is always going to be there. I'm not like saying that the colonial break is going to be complete, because I'm speaking to you in English. That is colonial, right? But like, I really want us to be creative. And I was hoping for me, the fun in this work really was going back to African philosophy, dredging up idiosyncratic symbology and making sense of it by using African life as the fodder, right? The meat, that this book wouldn't have been as meatier as it was without African philosophy. And I appreciated the fact that I did that. So I think that African ethnography is going to change. And now I think that the problem has to be with our white Africanists, right? They have to deal with how to engage with the new, what would be the new canon called African anthropology. And, you know, when power is slowly dissipating for those in power, there is always going to be the kind of rift we saw on Twitter, right? And so I even assume, like, my when I read, can I talk a little bit about that debate? When I actually saw that debate, I was like, oh, wow. So this is the way these writers, these ethnographers are trying to actually be in the way again, right? Because they realize where African anthropology is going. So then now they have to subsume themselves as Africans, right? To even do this ethnography, right? So I think that African anthropology is going to see a revival, and that revival is going to be seen in African studies, right? And quite frankly, I feel that we are seeing that already, right? It's been going on for a long time, but with the social mediaification of academia, that this is going to be further enhanced, right? So, yeah, I think my ethnography is one example of what African anthropology in the future would look like, I would hope. Jemima Pierre is coming out with a new book that is really going to also rattle. Quite frankly, I'm excited for that book, you know, because in that book, she's really changing the genealogy of African anthropology, right? We are not going back to the likes of Melville Herskovitz, right? What if we start African anthropology with an African anthropologist or with Antenor Fermain, right? Or with, what do you call him? What's his name? He's an African American anthropologist, not Eliot Skinner. I'm blanking out on his name, but like there are all these Black anthropologists who are the progenitors of African anthropology. So she's doing that kind of work, and I'm really excited for the horizons we are forging for ourselves in African studies, and all of us in the diaspora have to participate in that conversation, I would argue. So with this opportunity or this forum is one of the spaces where this forging is happening.
Yeah, thank you. That's really exciting. So thank you for telling us about, you know, what's on the horizon, but also, you know, how your work is really important and critical in what's going on, you know, currently in these debates. And I like how you said that the social mediaification is elevating these debates and it's making it more visible. So
right.
Which is not necessarily a bad thing. You know?
Right.
So, thank you for that. And so I think we have arrived at, my last question, which is what projects are you currently working on or what do you have on the horizon for, you know, for yourself?
Yeah, I'm really excited for this new project. I'm working on a project on electronic waste, which is very, very different from my first book. But I'm interested particularly in waste. And this is how it connects to the first book, because in the first book, I'm focused on queer subjects in very heteropatriarchal context. And because in this context, being queer makes you be read as wasteful, right? Because within the heteronormative order of things, procreation is what makes you, you know, a kind of a responsible generative citizen, right? And so queer subjects in Ghana or queer subjects everywhere too are sometimes read as wasting away their procreative capital, right? So I'm trying to connect that logic of waste in the realm of reproduction, right, to the logic of waste in my current project, albeit the logic of waste in the current project occurs in the realm of production, right? So waste as a queer object, you know, then is what I'm trying to, or is how I'm trying to enter this new project. Now, Ghana has the world's largest electronic waste dump, right? And so I'm working currently with a community of electronic waste workers, right? All of whom come from Northern Ghana, right? And Northern Ghana historically was where enslaved people were captured and, captured and kidnapped and taken across the Atlantic, right? So after slavery, Northern Ghana became the colonial reserve for labor. So cheap labor was siphoned to the south, right? And so in contemporary Ghana, Ghana is really sharply divided between the south and the north. If you are from the north, you are called a northerner, right? But then the northern part of Ghana is really the most diverse part of Ghana. It's much more diverse than the south, right? But if you're from the north, irrespective of your ethnic orientation, you are called a northerner, right? So I'm interested in the ways in which these logics of northernness, right, are tied in with the histories of slavery, the histories of colonial labor, and the ways in which these histories leave legacies or scars on northern subjects today, right? So I'm drawing a lot on the works of Bishara of Chuyo's at Anthropology and the Salvage Slot. I'm interested here in this project in the Salvage Slot as a theoretical device that allows me to think about the ways in which, you know, anthropology's obsession with the Salvage Slot has actually left ideologically this legacy, right, that underpins why waste has to go to Ghana. So Africa is a shithole precisely because of the construction of the other as existing in a salvage slot, right? So it becomes logical then that the salvage slot, right, replaces the salvage slot because that is where all the trash and everything is going. Does that make sense?
Absolutely, yes. And that sounds very interesting, and we'll look forward to seeing that when it comes out.
Thank you.
When you bring it to fruition. So thank you so much. I've been speaking to Dr. Kwame Edwin Atu, the author of the book Amphibious Subjects, Sasso and the Contested Politics of Queer Self-Making in Neoliberal Ghana, published by the University of California Press. Thank you so much, Kwame, for writing this book and for sharing it with us on the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me. This has been very exciting, and it's been wonderful having a conversation with you.